Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Hi, welcome to Willing to Adapt. I am Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
How's it going?
I'm doing good. How about you?
It's going great. Today's a nice rainy day.
Yes, it is.
I'm enjoying that. We needed it after all those crazy fires.
Very true.
Today, we are talking about Charles Dickens' classic, Nicholas Nickleby. Have you read that before today?
Did I read it before today?
Yes,
I did read it before.
You just read it all in one setting, right?
I sat down and I read all 760 some pages in one sitting. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you have nothing to do, you know, you're bored. I don't know.
I don't know if I could do that even in 24-hour period, considering the audiobook.
Well, not that. Definitely not Dickens. Dickens is not an easy read.
No, it's not. So, full disclosure, it did take me.
Longer than me.
Longer than you. I think it took me, about a year to read?
At least. Because, well, to be fair, I technically started before I said, let's read this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at the audiobook is 35 hours long on one version.
So. Is that it? That's all?
That's all.
How fast is he reading?
Is
it one of those where it's like double time? He's like,
No.
Like, Charles Dickens, Nicholas Nickleby.
No, actually, it was pretty good. It was a woman, and she did like some really cool voices on the parts I listened to.
Got it. Mm-hmm. My dad likes to listen to podcasts and audiobooks and things. He actually doesn't read physical books anymore, which I like physical books myself, but he will listen to things at double time.
I
don't know how he is able to do that. I take information visually a lot more than audibly.
Yeah.
And so I don't think I could retain information as well that way, period. But I will just be walking around the house and I'll just hear, this person walked over here. And they're going to blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh my God, Dad.
You know what? Some people can do it because I get to try it.
Kudos to him.
I'll have to try it. But there's a podcaster I listened to and he said I think he was saying like Audible or someone just put 3x speed.
Oh, God.
I was like, oh my, yeah, he talks fast too, though, so.
Yeah. Random little sidetrack here. I have a theory that I'm sure I'm not the first one to come up with because there's nothing new under the sun, but I have a theory that we perceive things to move faster or slower based on how quickly our brain is functioning.
So there is a philosopher, I'm just kidding, I'm not going to go down that road. I mean,
Do you want me to tell you why?
Why? Go ahead.
This is purely from my own.
Go ahead, events. Mr. Descartes.
Thank you. No. So I have noticed sometimes when I listen to music at different times in the day, like later in the day or something, there's music that seems slower. But then if I listen to that same song at the beginning of the day when I'm waking up, it feels really fast. But it's the same song. Nothing's changed. The only thing that I can think of that's changed is that I'm waking up. And so, like, my brain's not moving as quickly or, like, because I'm not, like, all, like, the connection's not making it. I don't know. Brain enough. But
I think there's validity, a lot of validity to be, you know, what you're saying. Yeah. I know there's a plethora of research in perception blah, 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 in this field and that field. And I'm sure.
There's definitely times where I've listened to the same song at different times of the day, and I'm like, this is a lot slower than I remember, or this is a lot faster.
Yeah. No, I think mood has a lot to do with it.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, the mood, like you said, whether you're waking up, because I experienced the same thing recently. I realized when listening to playlists. Like, have you ever done this where you have a playlist and you're one place and you can listen to the whole playlist and it doesn't bug you? You like all the songs, but then you're in the car and all of a sudden you're like, nope, skip, 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 skip.
That makes sense if only because I compartmentalize a lot.
Okay.
And so I have a wide range of eclectic playlists that I have made for very specific reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And moods.
Okay.
And so there are some that I cannot stand depending on what I'm doing.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
But those are very specific.
Okay.
So I think I understand what you're saying.
And so, speaking of compartmentalism, let's talk about Nicholas Nickleby.
I was gonna say, welcome to Willing to Adapt. We talk about neurology, and
I think Nicholas Nickleby is a great. That was a great segue regarding how Charles Dickens writes.
So, when we were talking last year about what are we gonna read?
Wait, when you say last year, are you talking a year ago or like 2024 December?
Oh, geez. Whenever it was that we were just trying to figure out what are we going to read
for season two?
No, season one.
Okay,
because this was originally going to be for season one.
That's right.
That tells you how long ago this was.
And then I started it, stopped, and then continued on. Yes.
And the reason why this was not on season one is not because of me.
It's a long read. So I'll explain why. I got really bored in the beginning.
You're fine. I'm not judging you. I'm not judging you at all. There are definitely times in the book where I was like, skip ahead. Yeah. Come on. I'm done with this part. I don't want to read this part anymore.
Yeah. And the opening up until Dothabai Boys Hall?
I think it's Dota Boys.
Dota Boys.
That's what they say in the movie. So.
Okay.
It has to be accurate.
Up until that point, I think it was fairly dull, and then it picked up. Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah, for sure. So, have you read Dickens before?
The only two I've read were in high school, Great Expectations.
Oh, you did read Great Expectations.
I did read Great Expectations.
Were you in an honors class?
I was.
That makes sense. Great Expectations was only required to the honors students.
Okay.
But I was the kid in high school that loved reading, and so when we had book fairs and stuff, they were selling books for like everyone in the school, on the tables it would say if you're in these classes you're going to need to read these books.
Oh, okay.
And I just remember seeing the honors books.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing a bunch of them that I was interested in anyway.
Yeah.
And so I remember I had purchased in high school on my campus a paperback copy of Great Expectations.
Okay.
And so that was one of the first books that I did read. But as a kid, I had a Great Expectations abridged version with illustrations that was meant for younger readers.
Oh, okay.
So it eliminated a lot of subplots and things.
And then the other one I read shortly after was A Christmas Carol.
A Christmas Carol is great.
I didn't appreciate it when I was younger.
Well, I think it's tough for younger readers nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this right now just because I don't know where else to say this. Dickens adapts well.
Okay.
It's easy to, he writes great stories.
Yeah.
And so when he writes short stories, I think they're the better ones because they're concise.
Okay.
I think it's not difficult necessarily to adapt Dickens as long as you're not afraid to cut things, because he is very long-winded.
Yeah, I noticed that.
But one of the things that I have learned about Dickens that helps me appreciate him now, and it's almost like a weird mind block that I had to get over. And it's similar to other things we've talked about in that it's reading something in a way that's different than what we're used to.
Mm.
And I think you came across this as well, is Dickens, most of his books, especially Nicholas Nickleby, which we're talking about here, were serialized.
Yes.
And so they were published over time.
Correct.
I saw in an interview somewhere, someone who's like a Dickens professor or something was saying, if you're going into Dickens for the first time, or you're new to Dickens, then you should get a copy of Dickens. He actually recommended Great Expectations. He said not because it's his favorite, but because it's probably one of his best written stories.
Yes.
He said you should get a copy of Dickens that has included the parts where it says the end of this publication.
Oh, okay.
So because it gives your brain a rhythm. He said it's reading a novelization of Dickens is the equivalent of watching an entire season of a TV show without the episode breaks.
Correct. Yeah, I realized that. Huh?
Dickens helped to popularize that form of serialization.
Oh, okay.
And so, and he wasn't the first, but he helped popularize it. And so the Victorian period especially became, that form of publication became very popular.
Okay.
The way that I explain that is similar to what I just said to people for modern audiences. It's very similar to watching a television show.
Yes.
In that it's not a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a television show and it's very episodic.
Oh yeah.
And it might have things that follow through to the end, mm-hmm. and it might not. It will have things that are just random for one episode.
Yes.
Just like definitely. If you watched, I was going to say Friends, but you don't watch Friends.
No, I don't.
The Big Bang Theory.
Big Bang Theory, yes.
So there are episodes where Sheldon mm-hmm. or someone will go off and do something with a random character that you never see again.
Correct, yeah.
Or someone's mom might come into the picture for one episode and then never come back.
In Star Trek, they call them ship in a bottle episodes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And they're very common.
Yeah.
They're very common because they don't continue the plot necessarily.
It's not like Lost.
Like, they might be important for characterization.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they might show you something about a character, or they might emphasize the theme, correct. Maybe. But they're not important for the whole plot. And so that happens a lot with Dickens in his yeah. books.
Yeah, I didn't catch on. The reason it took me a while to catch on is I didn't research before. I read it, and I didn't read the introductions. I've gotten to a point where
that's
I no
not
longer...
like you.
I know. It. I read somewhere, I don't remember what book it was, where they said not to read the introduction until afterward.
I'm of that mind as well.
Okay.
Because the introductions give away a lot.
So even for our last podcast, Princess Bride, I did not read the introduction, so the two of them, until the very end. Same thing here. So I caught on. It was episodic. I can't remember why or how. And something finally triggered in my mind because I was thinking of...
Arthur
Conan Doyle. It dawned on me. I think I might at that point look something up on the ever trustful Wikipedia and then realized,
they're actually episodic. A lot better than they used to be.
Yeah.
I think you still need to check the sources.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But they mentioned the episodic nature of it, or someone had mentioned it being like a soap opera.
Well, yeah. In many ways, it is.
Yeah.
It's a soap opera, but it's also a comedy.
Yeah.
I listened, we'll talk about the film when we get to it, but I listened to the audio commentary that was the director,
mm-hmm.
and he was talking about the making of the film and, but Dickens a lot as well.
Okay.
And one of the things that he praised Dickens on is Dickens is very aware that he needs to have a balanced story.
Mm-hmm.
Like he wanted to talk about very dark, troublesome things. But he was aware that the whole book couldn't be that because nobody correct. Would like it and nobody would want to read it and it would be too depressing. And so he has a relatively good sense of balance in his mm-hmm. stories, in that if you look from a macro level at his novels, especially this one,
yeah,
he bounces back and forth very fluidly between the really dark, scary, tragic moments
mm-hmm.
to the really funny, comedic moments.
Mm.
He's very good at introducing characters that are more upbeat and funny after really sad moments.
I didn't pay attention to that.
They said
but now that you mentioned
it, it's a lot of like lights and shadows.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and he has a very good sense of rhythm for that because he knows that audiences, or in this case, readers,
yeah.
need a reprieve from the really dark moments
mm-hmm.
and to prepare them for the next one.
Hmm.
That's something a lot of 20th century authors don't care about.
But I think too, but then that's when you get into the whole, are you writing for the popular culture or are you writing for artistic reasons?
Oh, for sure.
You yeah. know, and you see that in sure. movies today where they yeah. have all these artistic movies that are supposedly great and nobody goes and sees them because they're not entertaining. Sure. Yeah.
But I think that there can be some sort of balance. But, you know, if that's not your thing, it's not your thing. You know.
True. No, but I agree with you. There can be great stories that have moments.
So how were you first introduced to Charles Dickens? Was it just Great Expectations in high school?
No. So if you really go far back enough, my first introduction was through Mickey's Christmas Carol.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then that was probably mine.
It's still to this day is one of my favorite Christmas movies.
It is definitely one I watch every Christmas time.
I made my wife sit and watch it with me the last Christmas.
I think I watch at least 6 different versions of A Christmas Carol every Christmas.
Surprisingly, I've been wanting to watch the
Muppet one.
I've never seen that one.
Oh.
Everyone tells me how great it is, and I've just
let's not talk about it because we should just do A Christmas Carol this Christmas.
Okay, I'm gonna hold you to that one.
Although that would be like a 6-part episode because there's so many versions.
I hope my wife's not listening. I made a donation somewhere last year because she says I have too many books, and
I didn't realize that was a thing.
And so her thing is, I need to read more of them before I buy more of them.
Well, at least this podcast is making that happen.
And so I ended up getting a new illustrated edition of it. And I've been wanting to sit down and read it. And so if we do it for Christmas, it'll give me a reason. But I grew up also watching all the different, like the, not the Muppets, I never saw that one, but the Flintstones, Mr. Magoo. Oh, yeah.
The running joke is that everyone and their mother has done an adaptation yeah. of A Christmas Carol.
So after The Christmas Carol, the next introduction wasn't until Great Expectations, my senior year of high school, I think. And that's the first time I actually read it, like read Dickens versus watching an adaptation of it.
I think mine is similar in that it was A Christmas Carol growing up. And then I think my parents caught on really early that I like to read. And I think I've talked about some of my issues with reading when I was a kid for sure.
Yeah.
So I think my parents did a good job of getting me into some of the classics at a young age.
Oh, yeah. No, that's always a good thing.
I remember that one. I had the same company that did that one mm-hmm. did an abridged kids version of Frankenstein.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
That one was scary. Because the illustrations.
Oh.
It's a gothic story. And with the illustrations, it like is. You just see like the dismembered body parts and okay. things like that. I was like, ooh. You want to know a little bit about Dickens?
Go ahead.
Great. Charles John Hotham Dickens. He was born February 7th, 1812, and he died on June 9th, 1870. He was an English novelist, journalist, short story writer, and social critic. He created some of literature's best-known fictional characters, and he's regarded by many as the greatest novelist of the Victorian era. His works enjoyed unprecedented popularity during his lifetime, and by the 20th century, critics and scholars had recognized him as a literary genius. His novels and short stories are widely still read today. I was going to talk a little bit about his backstory because it does help explain a lot of what he talks about in his books. He was born in Portsmouth. He left school at age 12 to work in a boot blacking factory when his father, John, was incarcerated in debtor's prison. After 3 years, he returned to school before beginning his literary career as a journalist. Dickens edited a weekly journal for 20 years. He wrote 15 novels, 5 novellas, hundreds of short stories, and nonfiction articles. He lectured and performed readings extensively, was a tireless letter writer, and campaigned vigorously for children's rights, education, and other social reforms. His literary success began with the 1836 serial publication of The Pickwick Papers, a publishing phenomenon. His novels, most of them published in monthly or weekly installments, pioneered the serial publication of narrative fiction, which became the dominant Victorian mode for novel publication. Cliffhanger endings in his serial publications kept readers in suspense. The installment format allowed Dickens to evaluate his audience's reaction, and he often modified his plot and his character development based on such feedback. For example, when his wife's, I don't know what this is, chiropodist? I don't know. Let me look that up. A medical professional devoted to the treatment of disorders of the foot, ankle, and related structures of the leg. Oh, cool. The more you know. When his wife's whatever expressed distress at the way Miss Moucher and David Copperfield seemed to reflect her own disabilities, Dickens improved the character with positive features. His plots were carefully constructed, and he often wove elements from topical events into his narratives. Masses of the illiterate poor would have individually pay a halfpenny to have each new monthly episode read to them, opening up and inspiring a new class of readers. The Christmas Carol remains his most popular. He's written a very wide range of things. And do you want to talk about Dickens a little more, or do you want to move on to Nicholas Nickleby?
I mean, we could probably move on to the book. I know a little bit about him, so, and what you've filled in, the blanks there. The most I've learned about him was really on the intro from this book. I think we can move on to the book.
If anybody's interested in some of the behind the scenes of Charles Dickens and who he was, specifically in regards to A Christmas Carol, I would recommend watching or reading The Man Who Invented Christmas.
That's a movie, right?
It's a movie. It's originally a book.
Oh.
Yeah, but it's about how he ended up writing A Christmas Carol. But it talks about his person and a lot of like his baggage that he had because of like his father being in debtor's prison and him forced to work at the bootblack factory and stuff like that.
You know,
Christopher Plummer is also in that.
Really?
Yeah, he plays Scrooge.
Oh, okay.
He plays a great Scrooge.
And so I think the two things I learned I thought were very fascinating about him pertain to the novel Nicholas Nickleby was one in regards to when I think of there's a lot of the authors I follow today, they'll definitely do research before they write their books. Mm-hmm. And so to find out that he actually went to the Yorkshire schools in disguise, you know, to me was fascinating.
With his illustrator.
Yes. That was interesting. I'm like, wow, okay. He had firsthand knowledge. And the other thing, but this one pertains more to his history, is how Mrs. Nickleby is...
The mother in the book?
Is the mother in the book mm-hmm. is loosely based on his mother.
And I was going to, yes, okay. Yeah.
And so you mentioned his father, mm-hmm. but, I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. I read somewhere, and it's probably in what I'm going to read soon, but Nicholas Nickleby was the third book, eventually.
Yeah.
Serialization, then book, that Dickens wrote. The first was The Pickwick Papers, and then it was Oliver Twist.
Okay.
Which was a big book for him.
Was it bigger than this one?
Yes.
Okay.
Because it really introduced people to the orphan plight.
Mm.
And then he wrote Nicholas Nickleby.
Okay.
The full title is The Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby.
Yes.
We'll get to this a bit, but in the book, Mrs. Nickleby, Nicholas's mother, is in some ways very obtuse. She's not quite aware of a lot of the evils that are happening to her children. And she's, in a way, annoying. I found her insufferable.
Okay, I did too.
I could not stand her in the book. I will say right now, they mellow her out all in the movie. But
she like had no lines in the movie.
No, she's barely in the movie. But she's much more endearing in the movie.
Because I was prepping was sharing as I was reading the story to my wife. It's kind of like, you know, when you watch a brand new show and you're excited about the different parts that happen. And I kept on telling her, oh, just wait till you see Mrs. Nickleby. She, you know, she's horrible. She gets on my nerves. And then we watched the movie. I was like,
yeah,
never mind.
Yeah, I think they could have included some of that in the movie, but they definitely were strained on time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not important.
No. Yeah.
It's what happens a lot with Dickens is when you have to adapt and you have to cut things out, you end up losing a lot of characterization.
Yeah.
And a lot of nuancing.
Yeah.
The sad part is... One of the ways that Mrs. Nickleby is very similar in some ways to Charles Dickens' mother is Charles Dickens apparently never really fully forgave his mother because she didn't want Charles Dickens to leave the bootblack factory when the father was going to pull him out because he didn't need to be in there anymore because they were making enough money again.
Mm-hmm.
And so he never really forgave his mother because of that.
Hmm. I think I read that.
Like it
somewhere.
It seemed like she wasn't as attentive to Charles at the time that she should have been.
Yeah,
it was a horrible time for Charles.
Yeah,
like he was very abused, and
I actually was curious to see. I can't remember if I looked it up if there is a good biography on him.
It's I'm sure there is.
Yeah,
but
because unlike Shakespeare, I think we know a lot more about him.
Well, yeah, we would have to. Mm-hmm. We don't really know much about Shakespeare.
Yeah,
but I think before we go a whole lot further. I think it's important to give some context to the time period, and you could probably help out with this too. So something very important to talk about in regards to Charles Dickens is if you look at the time period, there was a lot of change that was happening before him, during his lifetime, and in many ways because of him.
Mm-hmm.
If a very quick history lesson here to all of our listeners, if you are not aware, I'm sure some of you are, so this is... repetition. But the Industrial Revolution, if you remember from high school or college, was a time period that began technically in around the late 1700s with the introduction of steam technology and other things.
Mm-hmm.
And very early in the 1800s, we were starting to get the beginnings of trains and steamships. But then we had other things like the cotton gin and other things that would help to speed up production. And then at the very beginning of the 1800s is when we started getting a lot of factories.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when we started seeing children go to work.
Yes.
And so instead of people working on farms or in trades, which was very individualized and like within a family and things like that. Now you're starting to see widespread factory work and people mm-hmm. moving into the cities. Like, cities were not as big before the Industrial Revolution. And so when the Industrial Revolution started, people were starting to move into the city. And the one of the pros is it could be a way for people to make a living on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But it did upset a lot of the way that society was run. And it was very dirty. It was very messy. It was very dangerous.
Yes.
And it was not like today where we have a lot of social reforms in place.
Mm-hmm.
We actually don't, in America, we don't have a lot of the social reforms that we recognize until the Edwardian period, which is around like the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw a lot of social reforms here in America, but it was because it was the end of the Victorian period where we saw the ramifications of the Industrial Revolution.
Correct, yeah.
It was mainly because of people like Charles Dickens who cast a light on the issues of the time. People kind of just took for granted a lot. And so people were not aware of things like the mistreatment of children or orphans or things like that, because mm-hmm. things were run very differently back then. And, you know, of course, we didn't have television or anything streaming.
Yes.
For sure. And so, you know, news traveled a lot slower.
Mm-hmm.
And so having people like Charles Dickens to raise awareness of, you know, children's rights or education issues or the dangers of working in factories or so on and so forth. Like, all of these different issues, like having these authors have literally write it into their books in such a way that was so realistic
mm-hmm.
and like tugged at the heartstrings of the readers, that is what helped get society to change a lot.
Yeah. And I think we've gotten so used to that in writers today that it's hard to picture a time in which there wasn't as many. And like, we're inundated with everything from social media to streaming services to just even TV. And I think many of us have gotten tired of just hearing messages. But back then in particular, this was, and I think part of it too is like, we all know people, or we hear about people in different fields, or we hear about things. But in many ways, we still live in a similar time where we don't want to think about the stuff that's happening far away. Now, for us, it could be, say, China, where children are making your sneakers.
You talk about the Congo.
Or, yeah, I mean, there's, yeah, the mines, the children in the mines. Is that what
you're talking about? Well, there's children in the mines, and there's basically just slave labor still.
Oh, yeah.
And it's all these countries fighting over the minerals over there because everybody needs them mm-hmm. in our phones and yeah. in
the lithium
for like batteries for electric cars.
Yeah.
And it's things that people want and we need, but we're also turning a blind eye to the ecological disaster that is happening and also the lives that are being destroyed.
Yeah.
Because people need and want these things, and they don't want to see what's happening.
And you're right. We purposely turn a blind eye to those things that impact the things that we supposedly need, like shoes and phones and stuff. And I think in some ways, I kind of wonder if Dickens saw that too in his era with the rise of modernization. And like, one of the things, I don't know if you read some of it, but what prompted him to go to find out about the schools?
It was one of those things where it was kind of like a badly kept secret and that people were kind of aware that these Yorkshire schools were not the best.
Mm-hmm.
But in the book, as we'll talk about it, there were these schools in Yorkshire, as we said, that, let me read it here. They were cheap boarding schools that were advertised in London papers with an emphasis on, quote, no holiday. So like, the kids would not come home over Christmas. And they were a very convenient place to dispose of unwanted or illegitimate children.
Mm.
As we said, Charles Dickens and his illustrator, Hablot Brown Fizz, traveled incognito to Yorkshire on a fact-finding mission in January of 1838. They encountered William Shaw, the headmaster of Bowes Academy, in whose school several boys had died or went blind from mistreatment and neglect. And that was the character that he based Squeers off of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit more slightly comedic exaggeration,
mm-hmm.
but it still Very true. But I don't, I think it was one of those things where it was kind of something that if you were a, if you were paying any sort of attention,
mm-hmm.
then you saw these things.
Okay.
But also, you know, if you were at the highest echelon and you only cared about yourself.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you were at the lowest and you just had to get through the day.
Yeah, and I take it back then to it's politicians were a lot different and they weren't trying to find a cause to fight for. I know.
Well, I think there's always been causes. It's just I think they've changed. And...
True. Because I know he had a low opinion of politicians. I read somewhere that's why they're not. He doesn't write them very, very positively.
Well, there's a politician in this that he basically just completely writes terribly.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, the one thing usually about Dickens is he does not usually write with he doesn't really write like with blanket characters.
Oh, okay.
Like he in Nicholas Nickleby specifically, it seemed like it very quickly could have been about a class
mm-hmm.
issues.
Yeah.
And it very easily could have been like the poor against the rich and like sure. how bad the rich are.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do look at Dickens, because he writes a lot about like the good poor characters.
Correct. Yeah.
But there are a lot of rich, high class aristocratic good characters
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
And so he's more moralistic and it's more about what kind of a person are you? It's not about class. It's not about how much money you have. It's more about what are you doing with what you've been given and are you caring about your fellow man?
Correct. Is this pre Marx? Or around the time Marx?
Marx came out during this time.
Okay.
Yeah, Marx started writing during, I think it was like 1840s, 1850s. Mm-hmm. Somewhere. It was definitely like in the Industrial Revolution. And yeah. so he was definitely seeing... The thing about Marx is he never saw the pushback against the Industrial Correct. Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
He's writing steeply in it.
Yeah.
And so he's seeing the worst.
Correct. Yeah.
And so to Marx had points, but he also... I disagree a lot with Marx. So.
Yeah. No, as do I. And I think that's because one of the things I remember in 2008, I remember writing something. I might have been an undergrad. I can't remember. And I remember thinking to myself, we've gotten to a point in our world where everything is seen as a struggle through the eyes of victimization, victimology.
Yeah, sure.
And equating this to Dickens and what you just said is that for me, that train of thought is always more realistic because I remember at that point, I think I might have been reading or I recently read a synopsis and watched the movie of Les Mis. And one of the things I liked, and I think he did something similar, even though his writing was a lot earlier, was that Victor Hugo also showed the same type of moralization, I think, that Dickens does, and that the rich are not all evil and the poor are not all good, you know, and it's not all...
it's like a humanistic approach.
It is, and sometimes the mistakes are made. Like even Nicholas's father, Nickleby's father was a good man, but flawed. Who led the family to ruin, you know.
Well, and then there are plenty of very poor characters who are very evil.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. And even, and I can even argue one of the aristocrats at the very end, at least, has, towards the end, gains his morals.
About Verisov?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I end up liking his character a lot.
Yeah. I did too. I think I liked, especially once I saw the movie version. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and then there's something to consider when you think about the class system that existed in England at the time and still mm-hmm. in some ways today, but it's not the same anymore. If you want to understand literature from this time period, you know, even going back to Jane Austen,
mm-hmm.
class does play a very important part
yes.
in the stories because it was such an important part to the society. But it was important in a way that it was just something that existed.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something people really thought about. For the most part, like you just existed within a class and there was some, you know, movement.
Yeah, I agree.
But it was one of those things where, you know, for our eyes in America, it's something that we don't quite understand at times. It's something we kind of reject. We have, you know, we have technically our classes, you know, we have the upper class, the middle class and the lower, you know, today still in America.
Yeah. I think there's
it's different.
It is. Cause I also think there's an, a intellectual class.
Oh, for sure. Like another, the intelligentsia.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But, you know, it's different in that we don't have like an aristocracy.
Correct.
Or things like that.
Well, I would kind of.
We don't have.
We
like
don't
a
have it in the same way that they did back then. Our classes, like, I think, are a little
monarchical,
undefined.
Aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
No, I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm not disagreeing on that. But it's different in that in this time period, there were expectations
Correct.
Of the aristocracy mm-hmm. and members of the aristocracy. Or even if you were just a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Because to be a gentleman, you had to own land. And so that was kind of like the main thing.
Yeah.
And so if you did not own land, you were not a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Today's standards, we kind of just say it as a thing. But it back then, it meant something. And so to understand some of it, there was a lot of expectations on the aristocracy
mm-hmm.
that you would essentially do something with your money to help others.
Yes.
And even in America, there's an idea of this too, because we stem a lot from European cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But from the aristocracy, there was an expectation that you would be a philanthropist, that you would look to help others below you.
Mm-hmm.
Even during this time period, there were those who didn't believe in God. But I think a lot of the idea comes back to that concept of God has given you this money, and how are you going to help people because God has given you this money?
Yeah.
Essentially. If you want to boil it down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a lot of that you will see in books of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of it that it doesn't expel it out to you because it just assumes that you knew it.
Yeah.
And later on, we'll talk about something that they change in the movie that doesn't make any sense for the time period. but usually you stuck to your class.
Mm-hmm.
It was not uncommon for you to move up, like want to move up
yeah.
to a higher class, or even within your own class to a higher level in your class. But very, very, very rarely did you go down. And if you did, it was because of a very bad mistake you made
mm-hmm.
or something outside your control.
And so it's not for freedom like yeah. Titanic?
Sure. I mean, you always get like the really romantic stories of like, I loved this person and we wanted to be together, and the only way to be together is to just forsake everything and go live yeah. together. Like, that has always happened, but it's more rare.
It is, yeah. It's unlikely to happen.
Yeah, and it goes a lot back to honor mm-hmm. and family and community and stuff that you don't see as much today, I think. But it was not uncommon for people who came from an aristocratic class
mm-hmm.
to lose everything. Because
yes,
of
that, yeah.
Because things were a lot more hectic and money and things moved a lot more freely, and you just needed one bad investment mm-hmm. to lose things, essentially.
Was Noggs aristocratic or was
yes.
he middle class? Okay.
He was a gentleman.
He was a gentleman.
And he lost everything.
Okay.
And then, you know, in the book, it even says that, you know, Nicholas is mm-hmm. a gentleman mm-hmm. and his father was a gentleman. They're just poor.
Yeah.
And so you look at characters from Dickens and you look at characters from Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we look at others, like in especially in Russia, 1800s literature, which we'll talk later about some of it, you will have people from an aristocratic background and who have titles who have no money.
Yeah.
For one reason or another. And it depends on culture. For Russia, it's different. We'll talk about that later.
Yes.
Because it's a very different culture. But you can literally be a gentleman or a gentleman's son or someone or have a title and have literally no money.
Mm-hmm.
But you are still considered that.
Correct. Yeah. And that's where we differ in America, is that our classes are not based on titles. Mm-hmm. So you can move up and you can move down, or you could stay where you are based on sometimes it's more a ray of thinking and a characteristic than it is money. Mm-hmm. And I think I honestly learned a lot of that by watching Downton Abbey.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Because there was an expectation, especially at this time period, that you kind of just stuck to your class.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were from an upper class and you were doing something for a lower class, it was out of the goodness of your heart, usually.
Yeah.
It was not uncommon for someone who was like a lord or someone to care for those under his care.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the lord or the mistress, the lady, whoever, would go out and check on people in under their care, under their patronage, essentially,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
That's something that you don't really hear in books from, like, Jane Austen,
mm-hmm.
but that is something that happened. Like, essentially, when we talked about Jane Austen, like, Elizabeth, when she became Elizabeth Darcy,
mm-hmm.
it was a part of her duties, essentially, to go out and care for people who lived like on their land and in the community, and to make house calls and to check on them and to like provide for them and to do things for them. And that was something, a responsibility that was expected of her.
Was it left over from the serfdom type?
A little bit. A lot of it is stems from the feudalism.
Patronage system.
The patronage system, yes. And that's where you get the idea of it was, you have like a really good lord or bad lord.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if were they actually doing their duties or not? And that's something that a lot of modern readers don't understand.
Yeah.
And I think, like anything else, like any government, any system in society has its flaws.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ideally, even democracy is amazing, but democracy has its faults. Democracy has a lot of issues. But, you know, I think the idea of this patronage system, ideally, is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always work out.
Correct, yeah.
But that's something to kind of understand in regards to the society and stuff. But the fun thing is that because it was the Industrial Revolution, a lot was changing.
Yeah.
Well, that's my rant. That's my historical rant. Hope you're sticking around.
You know what? I it was a good explanation of the times, because I think that's the one part, and that's what I hope you, our listeners, are getting from this podcast, is an understanding of things, I think, that are, I don't want to say whitewashed, but they're glossed over in movies.
Well, things are very simplified.
It's very simplified, yes. Mm-hmm. And so these are things that when you actually do read some of these works, they are a bit confusing if you haven't been exposed to them. Because like even for Downton Abbey, I think I'm watching the end of that system pretty much in England.
That's the main point of Downton Abbey.
Yeah. And so at this point, it was more the ups and downs of their investments and things like that. Mm-hmm.
You should watch Gilded Age.
I'll have to add it to my list.
It's good. It's the same creator, but it's set in America during the 1880s.
Yes, I remember watching it.
It's so good.
Streaming somewhere.
It's on Max.
Okay.
It's an original.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good.
Mm.
Christine Baranski's in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. I'm going to give the plot.
Go ahead.
There's a lot in here that I'm not going to say that's in the book, because there's a lot in the book. Okay. The plot. The very basic plot for Nicholas Nickleby. Hoping to provide support for his mother and sister, after the death of his father, Nicholas Nickleby turns to his uncle Ralph Nickleby for assistance. Ralph wants nothing to do with his late brother's family and feigns to help Nicholas by securing a position as assistant master at the Dotheboys Hall School in Yorkshire, run by unscrupulous Wackford Squeers. Nicholas soon becomes disgusted with Squeers' treatment or mistreatment of his pupils, and leaves, giving Squeers a sound thrashing or beating, and liberating a young boy named Smike, about 18, whom Squeers has mistreated for years. Nicholas and Smike move in with Ralph Nickleby's clerk, Newman Noggs, in London, and then travel to Portsmouth, where they take up acting in Vincent Crummell's touring stage company. On hearing of the mistreatment of his sister, Kate, at the hands of his uncle, Nicholas and Smike return to London. Nicholas secures employment with a philanthropic. Nicholas secures employment with the philanthropic Cheeryble Brothers and helps rescue Madeline Bray from the evil designs of his uncle and an old rich man named Arthur Gride, who plans to marry her. Smike dies from the years of abuse suffered at Squeers School, hints that it's tuberculosis, and is found to be Ralph Nickleby's son. Meanwhile, Ralph is ruined financially and he hangs himself, especially after learning of his son's death. Squeers is sentenced to transportation, his school is disbanded, and Nicholas marries Madeline Bray. I was very impressed at how concise this was.
Yeah, it was really concise.
Yes, this was from the charlesdickenspage.com.
Hmm, interesting.
Yes, I was very happy with it. It's scary. There's a complete list of characters, and it is enormous.
Oh, wow.
Look at that whole list. Look at how many characters.
That is a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot in the book that I definitely did not just mention right now, because he talks about a lot.
Yeah.
Some of the things I didn't mention, there's some subplots. And a lot of characters
yes.
that I did not mention. Some of them are the Mantellinis, mm-hmm. who Kate goes to work for. Basically, like, almost everything that can go wrong for the Nickleby family is because of Ralph. Ralph is always, like, kind of pretending to help them and then putting them in the worst positions possible.
Pretty much.
And, like, thrusting them into the worst people's lives. So, the Mantellinis, as a couple, they own a dress shop, and it just goes real bad for Kate real fast.
Yeah.
And then there's the Kenwig family and Mr. Lillivick, mm-hmm. who I could not care less about. I was kind of happy that Mr. Lillivick ends up with
back of the
their
family.
Landlady at yeah. the end.
That was definitely just a side quest, a side detour.
Oh, for sure.
Yes.
The one nice thing about Dickens is he does a great job of making things kind of connect.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll check in with characters periodically.
Yeah.
and it's helped. It's like I said, it's helpful to remember that this was serialized. And mm-hmm. so you kind of needed to go back and visit with characters every once in a while.
Yeah.
But sometimes characters just left. Sometimes they just stopped talking about them. It's like, I'm done with that now. And so it's you're not used to that.
Yeah.
But it's very, in some ways it's very realistic, but also very unrealistic.
So
because of the way that he characterizes people.
With the Kenwigses? Is that what they
the
were?
The Kenwig family.
The Kenwig yes. family.
Yes. They're the ones that were trying to get his money.
The
Mr. Lillivick. The like their uncle.
Was he was the water tax guy or
yes,
something. Yeah.
yeah. And they were like doing everything possible to like make him happy because they wanted mm-hmm. to be in the will. And
so I remember that part of the story. And then I remember he becomes their, so Nicholas becomes their tutor for French and other stuff.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden it ends. And I don't know if I missed it, mm-hmm. like if I was reading it and then fell asleep. But I continued reading and the next thing I realized he was moving on. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, wait, why did he stop being their tutor? I couldn't find that when I went back.
I don't remember. It's been too long. But there are enough things that just, random things that happen
yeah.
where Nicholas has to just move on to something.
And this is the soap opera aspect yeah. of it, TV show aspect.
Well, and the one interesting thing is
they start blending together.
Occupations, like jobs and things, mm-hmm. operated very differently back then.
Yeah.
In that it seemed so much more flexible.
Yeah, it did.
For better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like today where you have to go through all the paperwork and you have to like go through the government and stuff. It was very much more like under the table.
Yes.
And so it was kind of like, oh, I have a guy who can teach you French, or oh, I've got a girl who can make hats for you. And it's mm-hmm. like, great, send her tomorrow, or yeah. you want to start now, you know. It was much more like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the Kenwig family and Mr. Lillivick, who ended up marrying the woman that was with the Crummels, but then she left him.
The actress?
Yes, yeah. But then she left him.
For and
then,
a sea so captain then, or yeah. something. Mm-hmm.
And so then he ends up marrying the landlady who was very helpful and kind to the Nicklebys.
Who?
Mrs. McCreevy?
Who marries her?
Lillivick.
No, he doesn't.
Doesn't he?
No.
No, no, it's Linkinwater.
Linkinwater marries
it does.
McCreevy.
Thank
yes.
you. There's too many characters. I told you, it's been a while.
We haven't gotten to Linkinwater yet.
Not yet. I was happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lily Vick's story is kind of more like comedically tragic.
It is.
Yeah. Then there's the, oh my gosh, it's so random. This mm-hmm. is just one of those really random comedic moments in the book that's not in the movie at all. The man next door.
The man next
door.
Oh,
crazy
to
man.
The one
next door.
Yes.
There is a madman who lives next to the Nickleby family's cottage for a while in the lighter part of the novel, and he falls instantly in love with Mrs. Nickleby, and he repeatedly throws vegetables over the wall in their garden as a token of his affection. To Kate's distress, Mrs. Nickleby refuses to believe that her suitor is insane until he suddenly switches his attentions to Miss LaCreevy.
And then the mom gets all hurt.
Yes.
That was funny.
And then she pulls one of her, like, I never trusted him.
She was a worse version of Elizabeth Bennet's mother.
I like Mrs. Bennet.
Yes.
I could not stand Mrs. Nickleby. Like, there was a small amount of her that I found endearing.
Oh, Bennet?
No, Mrs. Oh. Nickleby. Like, there was a small amount of her that I was like, okay, you're kind of funny. But it just went too long.
It did. And I, when she wouldn't believe her children and fell for
no,
the,
it was so
two
frustrating.
Rich guys. Yeah, it was annoying.
the way that I look at Dickens, especially in this story, is it's very similar to what you said. It's kind of like a soap opera, mm-hmm. but with a lot of comedic moments too, where it's what's going to happen to Nicholas this week?
Yes.
And I think that's the best way to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Actually, no, I agree. If you go into it, this particular book or these type of books, and you go into it with the mentality of a novel, of just sitting down and getting a whole story, it might get on your nerves after a while. And so when I switched my mindset to that way of looking at it, like, what's going to happen now? All right. You know, and I kind of read a chapter, waited for next week, you know, well, I didn't really wait a week, but the next day, and then picked it up. It made it a lot more enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to talk about is this is, again, one of those books where I'm aware that we are two fully grown men talking about this,
mm-hmm.
and that we don't have a woman here talking about this. True. But let's talk about the women in this novel.
Okay, actually, yeah, I did have actually that on my mind.
I was going to say that some people have opinions,
mm-hmm.
And on both sides, like everything in life. I wanted to talk to you about the women in the novel because I wanted to say, just as a buffer, that from a perspective for the time,
mm-hmm.
I think, especially in this book, that Charles Dickens writes some very interesting female characters.
Hmm.
Because I think from a cursory reading,
mm-hmm.
you could read these female characters very much as like, oh, they're just helpless. And man, they just need the men to save them and stuff. But when you look at a lot of other books for the time, and then you look at how Charles Dickens wrote the women in the book, these women actually have more agency.
Okay.
Especially during a time when women did not have much.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of the women in this book, even if you look at Mrs. Mantalini, who mm-hmm. was just totally like her husband was just using her for her money. But even like she had a lot of influence and sway, and like she had her own business yeah. and stuff. But then Kate like ends up standing up for herself a few times mm-hmm. and like putting her foot down and saying like, no, what you're doing is not okay. And that sort of thing, like within like what she could do. And then even with Madeline Bray, which she's probably the one who seems to have the least amount of agency. Like she still she still goes out and like works.
Yeah. Sells her paintings.
And sells paintings and like does what she can mm-hmm. to get by and support her father and herself and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so like there's a lot more to it, and like I know there's an argument that for whatever, but I wanted to pick your brain about what you thought about.
So I think it kind of goes back to our previous discussion in regards to class. And in this case, I will say that I have like most people today, I think my understanding of things is clouded by critical theory, critical understanding of class and sex and stuff like that.
Explain that to listeners.
So essentially, most people today are taught that women are underprivileged, there's a patriarchy, and they've had to fight for their rights, and they look at it as a power struggle. Okay. And I'm not going to say that there have not been times in which there has been a struggle and things have had to, you know, there have been things that have needed to be challenged. But as I've gotten older, as I've matured, I think I've moved away from looking at the world that way. And maybe I look at it not even as a moral, like we were talking earlier, as Dickens writing as a moralist. I think it's more looking at it as a bigger picture in the flow of history. Mm-hmm. And so I really like the way you just explained it, because what I saw when I was reading was less so much the power struggle or where the women were or what kind of power they had or what they did or the agency, as I thought, his women are very flat as characters. And so it wasn't until I was reading a little bit elsewhere.
Some of them, and then you get the ones that are like really memorable.
Correct, yeah. But I read someone who was talking about Dickens' writing styles, and they mentioned that the women in this novel are flat, but it really was more to do with his maturing as a writer. And then when you get to his later writings, it changes. It's like he understands women more and fleshes them out.
Especially when you get to
Great Expectations. Exactly. That was the one they showed as the pinnacle of his understanding.
I also think, real quick, mm-hmm. I think a lot of it also depends on the focus of the novel.
Correct.
Because in this one, we didn't really say it, the main focus in this one is Nicholas's relationship, his friendship with Smike.
Yes.
Like
yes.
That is like the heart of the novel. Mm-hmm. And it's the one that really carries through the whole thing.
You're right. Yeah, it does. And it is. And it's what informs his writing as he does. And I think a lot of it, too, is he writes characters. I'm going to guess this because I don't know enough. But I'm wondering if he writes his characters based on his life experience. So, sure. Therefore, Mrs. Nickleby is very fleshed out because he has a grudge on his mom. Yeah. Right. You know, and then you have the schoolmaster and you look at him. Because even when you look at, what is the schoolmaster's name?
Squeers.
Yeah. Compare him to Ralph.
Well, and his wife. His wife is a fleshed out character, too.
She is. And you compare both of them to Ralph Nickleby, mm-hmm. and both of them are a lot more fleshed out than the uncle is.
Yeah. Well, Ralph is interesting because he, in a way, is kind of nuanced.
I think towards the end.
Well, it hints early on, but then near the end for sure.
And that was the other thing is I wonder...
He's not a flat, evil character.
No. I think it starts coming out in his caring for... Kate,
for Kate's,
a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was interesting. We'll talk about that too.
And I think it seems like some of his writing comes through the growth process as he's writing these stories. And then,
like we said, sometimes he changed things based off of readers' perception and feedback.
And I think that kind of shows it shows a good writer, someone who's willing to learn and grow their craft.
Right. It's interesting because one of the things about this story, I think a lot of people have said this and I kind of agree with this, in a way it's kind of a coming of age story for Nicholas, mm-hmm. because the story essentially opens with the death of his father.
Correct.
Now he is the head of the family. Mm-hmm. He is the only son, and he, in this time especially, it is expected that he will take care of the family.
Yes.
It is expected that he basically will do whatever he has to care for his mother and his sister. Mm-hmm. And there was like no question at the time that a young man would do that.
Yeah.
And if he didn't, he was a terrible person.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't really expected otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so even in the book, there's times where like Kate is being assaulted by someone or mm-hmm. something is going very down very negatively. And it's wait until my brother comes.
Yeah.
Or I need to be there for my sister. Mm-hmm. I need to do this. I need to be, like, for lack of a better, like, I need to be the man, you know?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Like, gender roles were much more, not necessarily rigid, but there were a lot more expectations that came with them.
Yes.
At the time.
Yeah.
And that's something that we, especially here in America in this time, don't quite understand as much. Mm-hmm. I think we're kind of seeing a pushback to that in some ways, mm-hmm. With some of the pendulum swing here going on.
Correct,
but
yeah.
I liked that.
Yeah. No,
I agree. Seeing that a lot. And in the book, to the point of Nicholas Nickleby's character, he starts off, because he's supposed to be like 19. Mm-hmm. He starts off like he's very young and he and his family are sad because of the death of his father. And it's, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Like, we have nothing.
Yeah.
His father made a bad investment because of Ralph. And then they lost all their money. Mm-hmm. And so now they're going to London to get help from their uncle, who they haven't seen in a very long time and who wants nothing to do with them. And Nicholas is like, I'm just going to have to take a job. Like, I'm going to have to work anything I can to help. And Kate goes and gets a job too.
Yeah.
It would not have been expected for Kate to work mm-hmm. at all, but she got a job to help. And the mom, there would have been no opportunity basically for the mom to do anything at this time period. Yeah. Like, it seems like the mom is mooching off her children. But during this time period, there really would not have been anything for her to do. Mm. There would have really been almost no job available to her at her age and her time in life and station.
Especially, because I think back then they wanted people with experience and who were younger. Mm-hmm. 'Cause they know they could work longer and harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she and technically, like, they were still, like, he was a gentleman mm-hmm. and she was a gentleman's wife. And
so she had no
and
skills.
Kate was a gentleman's daughter. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that Kate goes and gets a job is actually crazy.
Yeah.
Like, but it goes to show that she cares for her family too. Mm-hmm. And that she's willing to humble herself and do it. But in the book, like I was going to say, it shows character growth in Nicholas in how he responds to characters in the book over time. Mm. In the book, he's much more violent.
Yes.
It's much more of like, it comes out of like an emotional response. Mm-hmm. And then slowly over time, he uses his words and his knowledge more, and he stands up for characters mm-hmm. Like his family or other people.
Yeah.
And at first, he's standing up for himself, But then he stands up for his family, and then he starts standing up for other people beyond his family. So when he gets to Madeline Bray at the end, he stands up for her not because he's in love with her, even though he is.
Yeah.
He stands up because of an injustice.
Correct. Yeah.
But now he's used like his wisdom and his knowledge and like his connections to do this good thing. And so you can see in his character, in a way, like this sounds really negative, but in a way, Madeline's character did not need to be very well-rounded because it was more important to show Nicholas's character change through the circumstance.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense, because I did feel she was a unfleshed out character, but I didn't really see why she needed to be.
Well, and she doesn't show up until the end of the book, really. Like, she's hinted at early, like once when he sees her at like trying to get a job,
temp agency or wherever
he was. Yeah,
but really wasn't a temp agency, but
yeah. Their but I will one. Say you do see a bit more characterization in her in the book than in the movie, in my opinion.
You know what? I'll agree with you on that, because I didn't really think about it.
Well, because they cut down a lot for the film. But I like it because essentially this is a story about a man learning to be a man. Like a man learning to be there for other people. A man learning what it means to not respond emotionally in situations and making it worse.
Yeah.
A man like learning to have self-control, but also like be the head of the household and to look out for injustices and to help others and so on and so forth. So I really liked this book, but I think I had to finish the book to like the book. Yeah.
I started liking it when I paid more attention to his writing style.
Mm-hmm. I want to read it again. Mm-hmm. Not right now because we have too much to read.
Yes, we do.
But I would love to read it again, but read it like episodically.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah. Cause I really tried to pummel through this and that was rough. I think one of the things I love about this book is just how well connected it is. There's so many characters that come in and out, but are connected.
Yeah.
And again, spoilers. I don't even know where to start because they're so well connected. But the biggest one is when Nicholas goes to the Dota Boys Hall and he meets Smike. Smike's been there basically all his life. He barely remembers a time before being there. But his time was so sheltered and like just stuck up in a room and stuff, you know, and he's just alone and nobody wants him. And he keeps waiting for like somebody to send a letter and and ask for him or whatever. And nobody comes.
Yeah.
And Nicholas becomes like a surrogate father to Smike. It's essentially his relationship with Smike that starts opening that door to character growth in Nicholas.
Yeah.
Like standing up for things, the injustices he's seeing in the world. And I read somewhere someone was saying the beauty of Nicholas Nickleby is it's Nicholas and Kate, his sister, who are good people learning how to be good people in an evil world and like not allowing the evil to change them. And when you look at it that way, it's actually very beautiful.
Yeah.
Because that is essentially what happens in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's them pushing back against it, you know?
Yeah.
And I love that, but so in the book, you find out eventually at the end after Smike has passed that Smike is the son of Ralph.
Correct. Yeah.
Like Ralph had married a woman, but he kept it a secret because her family would not have allowed her to have the money from like the will and the will if she had married without their consent. And so he kept the marriage a secret, which when she got pregnant, he had to keep the baby a secret.
Yeah.
And so then the baby was sent away. Then he was just told the baby had died. And then his wife ended up leaving and going to live with someone else, essentially. Yeah. You know, like she was not getting the love from Ralph. And, you know, like he married her for the wrong reasons. He wanted the money. But you find out in the end that Smike is first cousins with Nicholas, which is, I think, really fun.
Yeah, it's a good plot twist.
I mean, even more than that, it's fun because, what is it? So Kate is invited to a dinner at Ralph's house really early on. And it seems at first like Ralph's just kind of looking out for her. And then you start to realize that he has her there under very bad pretenses.
Yeah.
And that he has all these investors there who are aristocratic, who essentially are just like eyeballing Kate mm-hmm. and saying very nasty things to her. And there's Lord Mulberry Hawk, mm-hmm. this old, very terrible guy, aristocrat. And he has a guy he's taken under his wing who's another aristocrat named Lord Frederick Verisoft. And then I'm sorry if you're going to get confused with all these names. But it's cool because Dickens does a great job of showing character growth in side characters too. Mm-hmm. In that Lord Verisoft starts off very similar to Mulberry Hawk, but he realizes how Kate has been impacted negatively in this dinner.
Yeah.
And so that starts to open the door in his mind of, this isn't okay. Mm-hmm. And so over time, he starts to push back against Lord Mulberry Hawk until he actually stands up for Nicholas and his sister and his family, and he condemns Lord Mulberry Hawk for what he has done all along.
Yep.
There's a scene where Nicholas overhears a conversation when he comes back to London to help out his family, especially his sister, because of circumstances, and he hears a bunch of horrible things that Lord Mulberry Hawk has been saying about Kate. Mm-hmm. Very terrible things. And Nicholas goes and stands up for her. And he says, I am her brother, yeah. and I refuse to hear these things, and you, like, I demand you apologize, and so I want to know your name. And, of course, it was very unhonorable, ungentlemanly for Lord Mulberry Hawk not to give his name. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Lord Verisoft eventually just flat out condemns Lord Mulberry Hawk, and eventually he, like, calls him out into a duel.
Yeah, at the very end of the book.
But he stops Lord Mulberry Hawk from doing more harm to Nicholas and his family. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, Lord Verisoft is killed in the duel. But it does mean that because it was illegal at to duel point,
yeah.
at this time. And so it did mean that Lord Mulberry Hawk had to flee to France.
Yeah.
And then it shows in the epilogue that he ended up losing all his money, and mm-hmm. he had to come back to London, to England, and then he ended up in debtor's prison. So that was cool.
It was.
Basically, behind everything that's going on is Ralph. Mm-hmm. Like, Ralph is the one behind almost everything.
Pulling negative. All the strings, pretty much.
Yes, yeah. Because he wants the money. Like, he wants money from people. Mm-hmm. And it ends up, it's fun because his downfall is himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. His desire to control. I mean, granted, I think the thing that finally brought him down too, not completely, but is the losing of the money.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Losing the money. And then it was interesting because it mentioned somewhere that one of the things that I think kind of helped to break him mm-hmm. is when he realized that his son, who was Smike, had been alive all along.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then he found out because he knew Smike. Mm-hmm. And there's even a subplot in there where Ralph, like, worked with Mr. Snawley, who was, like, a random character who early on sent two of his boys to the Dota Boys school. Mm-hmm. He convinces them, like, pays them off to pretend to be Smike's father so that if only for the only reason to separate Nicholas from Smike.
Yeah.
And make them unhappy. And it, of course, doesn't work out in the end. But Ralph knew Smike. Mm-hmm. And what I think one of the things somebody wrote about that helped break Ralph in the end is he learned that not only was Smike his son, but Smike hated him. Mm-hmm. Like, Smike hated Ralph.
Yeah.
And so that kind of opened up the emotions in Ralph, mm-hmm. in a sense. And so then he ends up going and looking at the room that he lived in and then kills himself.
Yeah.
But he was, at that point, like, going to lose everything anyway.
Yeah.
So he lost literally
everything. Yes, he did.
It got a little interesting, a little artistic there at the end with Ralph, like, hearing the soldier singing his song and stuff outside the window.
That happened in the book too?
Yeah.
I forgot about that part.
Yeah, it was random.
Okay.
Like, it was purposeful, but it was random.
Okay.
I had to remember because I was a little confused because I hadn't read the book in a while mm-hmm. over why Arthur Gride was going to marry Madeline. Mm-hmm. And then I remembered when I looked it up that Madeline was going to receive a lot of money from her grandfather. Mm-hmm. But she didn't know that.
Yeah.
And even her dad didn't know it mm-hmm. because was it Arthur Gride had the will.
Yeah.
Like, he was hiding the will. Mm-hmm. And so he was planning to marry her and then get that money.
Yeah.
And it was fun because, like, part of the reason why the truth comes out is because Arthur Gride's deaf housekeeper was stealing from him, and then she stole the will, and then she learned about it.
Yes.
And then she she took it to the Cheerable Brothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of twists on there.
There were a lot of twists and turns, and a lot of... It almost seemed like it was convenient, but if it wasn't for the fact that it was like a well-oiled machine, then it wasn't really convenient so much as like it was well planned out.
Yeah.
So I know this was a long episode. I think Dickens is one of those where you have to really kind of talk about context. Yes. And
no, there's a lot that is different from our time period, and so it's good to lay a foundation. Mm-hmm.
Stick around, and we're going to talk about in the next episode the 2002 film Nicholas Nickleby.
Correct.
And we'll talk about the changes, and there were some.
Yep.
All right. I hope you enjoyed this one.
Yes.
I hope we didn't bore you.
No, I'm hoping I know our audience. If you're listening to us, you like us talking about this stuff.
Yes. I know exactly what my dad's going to say.
So. Next time on Willing to Adapt.
Mm-hmm. A great cast.
It was.
On the commentary, McGrath joked and said that because they had such a great cast, he was worried. He's like, if someone just dropped a bomb on us right now, we would lose so many good actors. Well, if you don't know what to do, you just end up a sailor. And Nicholas is like, whatever we have to do, like, I'm not going to leave you, you know?
Yeah.
He's so loyal. I love it. The concept of like characters falling in love in older literature is just different.
Yeah.
And that's something the movie doesn't cover. That's something the movie's not interested in.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It's not important. But it was interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, it definitely showed his character. I forgot about this, but the movie rearranged a couple things. Did you catch it?
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt. Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.